when the war began, it was like a catalyst to where punk rock bands, new school, old school, mid school punk rock bands, kind of demonstrated their vitality like nobody else.
Welcome to Behind the Setlist, the podcast where artists tell the stories about the songs they perform live. I'm Jay Gilbert from Label Logic.
And I'm Glenn Peoples from Billboard. In this episode, we talk to Eugene Hutz, the frontman for the incredible band Gogo Bordello. You know, Jay, I think the best thing about Gogo Bordello is there's no other band like Gogo Bordello.
No, absolutely not. They are a force of nature. Gogol comes from Nikolai Gogol, a Ukrainian writer. It heavily influenced Eugene and the band, and he's sort of smuggled Ukrainian culture into Russian society, which Gogol Bordello intends to do, you know, with their style of music in the English-speaking world.
We talked to Eugene about a documentary about the band that came out earlier this year called Scream of My Blood, a very good look at the band and its upbringing, his upbringing, his roots in Ukraine, his musical roots, very interesting stuff. And you really get a sense of how the band came to be. You know, we talked a lot about, you know, in particular, a Sonic Youth show in Kyiv that he went to and a lot of people in the music scene back then went to that he described as a pivotal moment.
Yeah, you're right. It's an amazing documentary. Here's the description of the documentary that I read online. It said, spanning the final days of the Soviet Union all the way to pre-9/11 New York and ending with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Scream of My Blood is as much about how the world shaped Gogol Bordello as how the band shaped the world.
Last year, the band released their ninth studio album, Solidarity. And earlier this year, they released a benefit single for Ukraine called United Strike Back. And in November, the band relaunched as Casa Gogo Records with a single collaboration with Bernard Sumner of New Order, Joy Division fame.
Yeah, and without further ado, here's Eugene Hutz with Gogo Bordello Behind the Set List. Let it roll.
Eugene, thanks for joining us on Behind the Set List.
Yeah, hell yeah. Likewise, thank you for having me. There we go.
You know, we watched the documentary Scream of My Blood recently.
All right.
And I imagine the filming for that began before the war in Ukraine with Russia.
It began about 15 years ago.
So before.
at least. And there wasn't actually filming for documentary. It was just a very close friend of ours traveling along with a crew and going to, you know, Latin America with us and, you know, Israel, other places, just going around the world with us, you know, and experiencing touring as part of the crew, you know, as a band kind of kept expanding and building and becoming a globe trotting, you know, band beyond, you know, New York City's.
There's so much footage in that film. Was that a member of the road crew or just a friend going along filming you as you toured?
Nate Bummer is a professional videographer, and he's been actually involved with quite a few cool projects, you know, with Kim Gordon's documentary and many things for Vice, you know. And I met him as a video director for a friend of mine, for this punky band from Vermont, actually, all the way back from there. And, you know, we got introduced. And then when I moved to the city, he started coming, checking out Gogo Bordello and kind of became, a secret member of the band, you know, with a camera in the hands. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't get that sort of footage unless you're kind of embedded with the group.
Absolutely. And the best part about it is that it wasn't supposed to be any kind of documentary. I mean, that agenda usually already kills the vibe, you know. is one of my favorite documentaries of all times. Is 91 Year Punk Broke.
Yeah.
Features Sonic Youth and Nirvana and Dinosaur Jr. and Babes in Toyland are there. A couple other bands. There's Iggy appearance on there.
Yeah.
And the thing about it is that from the makers of the film, the maker of them, chiefly, I think it was basically shot by Thurston. You know, he was like, it was made for absolutely no reason. Like, it was before Nirvana hit it big time. And therefore, everybody had this inner freedom to basically, you know, be who they are and be as eccentric and flamboyant as they please and just cause chaos, you know, bring additional chaos to the world.
Sonic Youth was very influential to a lot of bands, and I don't think they get the credit for that. I've read that the reason that Nirvana wanted to sign with DGC Records is because that was a label that had Sonic Youth.
Absolutely. I was following all those events pretty closely because, to me, Sonic Youth is a definite influence, and everyone in my circle of friends, you know, we can't even think about New York City without Sonic Youth, you know. So I'm firmly part of the crew where Sonic Youth is heavily credited and continues to be credited, especially that the very fact that I live in New York City is connected to Sonic Youth. I mean, I saw them at their one and only ever show in Ukraine, and when I was 15 years old. And it completely blew my mind. And I was like, I got to go where that music is coming from. And that music is coming from New York City. So, you know, just a couple of years later, I was here.
What did that do to the underground music scene in Ukraine when the people who saw that Sonic Youth show? What were the after effects?
So, exactly. There is a little documentary about alternative music scene in Ukraine of that era, and literally 90% of people in the documentary have something to say about that show. Everybody went there to that concert to see this very obscure art band, art core band, you know. As it was the first time I actually heard the word hardcore. Mm-hmm. But on the top of that, they had this spin. The preview was that it's actually artcore. It's hardcore, but it's artcore. And I was like, all right, we got to go and check this out. And everybody went there in a kind of clean slate in their mind. And what it did, it hypnotized people. I think they were in one of their peaks. I mean, you know, they had quite several peaks. And it was the Dream Nation era where they were kind of in their hardcore and artcore phase. And the effect was just hypnotic. It was beyond people's kind of discussion. It was just like, you everybody, this is the revelation. This is a highly dissonant, yet very somehow pleasing to our distorted senses.
Yeah. It seemed from watching that in the documentary, that was sort of a game changer. But you have a lot of different influences, and I think that's why your music doesn't sound like anything on the planet. You talk in the documentary about things like Black Sabbath and these metal bands and, you know, how great that was and what a great influence. But you also talk about Sonic Youth and punk bands. But I was reading this article the other day where you had cited like Jimi Hendrix and Parliament.
Absolutely.
So there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, well, a lot. And it continues a lot going on because I, for one reason or another, I've just always been kind of polyglottic about music, even though I have my like strong anchors in music that are definitely more like definitive for me. Mm-hmm. But well, when I first moved to Lower East Side, you know, I started hearing reggaeton coming out of like, you know, cars and bodegas. You know, I lived on Ridge Street, Avenue C, Ridge Street, housed in that area. And I was blown away by the power of that, you know, just completely brutal, primitive dancehall beat. This was way before Daddy Yankee blew up and like became a thing. I'm talking about like, you know, 97, 96. I mean, there is always like all these things have something to offer. So, you know, I just kind of ended up doing, you know, some experiments even with that, you know, like mixing Balkan music with reggaeton and stuff like that as a DJ. So it's really kind of, you know, it's kind of you write your own symphony out of all these influences. And I also was extremely fortunate that my father is the same way. So I picked up a lot from him, especially Jimi Hendrix and Parliament and all that. That was just my father's record collection back in Ukraine.
And he's a musician too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, him being like a kind of guy who's always seeking out the latest vibration, you know, I grew up exposed to that, you know, it just was like, and his brother too, he's a painter. So being babysat by a painter, you know, and I remember that, you know, being 4 or 5, you know, 6 years old in an art studio, you know, him and his friends, you know, long hair and pants covered in paint, music playing, always either some prog rock, either something, you know, extreme like Jimi Hendrix or one thing or another. But years later, after I, you know, got already into punk scene, where people were just very eclectic and listening from everything from GBH and Exploited and Veruckers to like, you know, Joy Division and Kraftwerk. Somebody gave me a tape with Kraftwerk and I was like, this is not new. This is like, I've heard it when I was like 5 years old. And then retract back that, you know, my painter uncle was listening to Kraftwerk like 1977 when I was tiny, you know. I was like, wow, this is they were really, really spearheading all these musical influences and frequencies, absorbing them. So that was the situation. And I just followed into that footprint, you know.
One of the bands you cover live is the punk band Fugazi. And in your recent show in DC, you played a snippet of Waiting Room. You covered Blueprint in the encore. And I'm wondering, what is it about Fugazi that attracts you to them? And is that something you learned about in the U.S., or were you familiar with Fugazi back in the Ukraine?
So Fugazi is also particularly influential. It's probably like, as I said, you know, one of those anchor influences. I arrived here and quickly was kind of befriended a whole crew of really awesome punk kids who I started traveling around, seeing shows with them, you know, along East Coast, not only in Vermont, where I was originally, but, you know, going to Albany and, you know, seeing shows. And Fugazi absolutely just blew my mind, because it became like my answer to everything for a long time, because it was extremely polyglottic like that, you know. As a fan of like Joy Division and, you know, Gang of Four and, you know, and dub and hardcore and artcore, you know, Sonic Youth. I kind of saw that this band is all of those things. This is a real fusion that has that high adrenal charge and does have all those influences that are very European and American, but on like a really, really quintessential level. Like, you could hear the Gang of Four and Joy Division and Sonic Youth in Fugazi, but made entirely their own, you know. And I thought that that was just the highest artistic accomplishment. And, you know, I consequently saw them about a dozen of times, you know. That connection actually kept working, because when we started to tour with Gogol Bordello, like on tiny, tiny tours, first touring. Some of the first people that came backstage and surprised us with their appearance was, you know, Brandon and Guy, you know, and some years later, you know, Joe and Ian. And so it's like that somehow world traveled to them, that they got to check this vibe out. And, you know,
it's all come full circle. Yeah.
Yeah. And Joe and Brandon were at this show, you know, and so I was like, that's why I covered several songs, you know, one for each.
Got it. So watching the documentary, there were so many things in there that were just joyous and so many things that were just, well, punk, like music on X-rays, which I had never heard about. And I just think that is so cool for our audience that's never heard of that before. Tell us a little bit about music on X-rays.
Well, I think for us, it was like such a commodity, really, because I wasn't the only kid in Kyiv at the time who had a father who is pretty hip and into all that. There wasn't many, but it's like, seems like we all knew each other. But amongst my friends, that was quite widespread thing, since there was not a one single outlet in Soviet Union that could deliver you music that you want, except for, you know, black market, you know, which not a lot of people know their way to, you know, to these gatherings. You know, before that, a way of having records was, if you have a friend who works in a hospital and has access to X-rays, which are essentially vinyl, you know, and you have another friend who works, say, in theater or in television, that has phonograph recording the trail cutting mechanism, you know, which is used for making soundtracks and radio programming, pre-recorded, all that kind of thing back then. So, you know, you put those two friends together and, you know, you heat the vinyl up of X-ray, and they literally cut the record on this just more flimsy vinyl, which looks awesome and eccentric because it's like somebody's rib cage or somebody's, you know, right, other part of the body. But it goes well if, like, it's a Black Sabbath record, especially, or, you know, Cure or Bauhaus, you know, goes great together. Great look. And same time, their quality wasn't lasting. I mean, after about 7, 8, 9, 10 listens, the quality would really go down because it's just, needle eats that vinyl really, really fast. And, but, you know, those things were kicking around and, you know, curious, like, what are they? You know, and my dad was like, well, that's when you were like 2, 3 years old, that's how the records were, you know.
Yeah. Very cool.
You know, and, yeah, I think that I did read some kind of hipster blog about it. So people somehow start finding out that that was the thing in Eastern Europe at the time, you know, which is kind of fascinating how much creativity people put in into getting around the, you know, all this idiotic Soviet dictatorship regulations, you know.
I got to admit, I have not been on eBay yet looking for those, but I'm going to do this after this conversation and see what pops up.
I'm sure there are some. I'm sure there's somebody who's just busting them out and claiming that they are a relic.
Sure.
So let's talk about your set list. And I'm wondering if there are songs that you think are kind of mainstays to a Gogo Bordello set list that you want to drop in a set every time, that are your favorites or that are crowd favorites.
That are both of those things. I mean, it's an advantage for the band to have like quite a few albums out and have a lot of crowd pleasers, you know, but at the same time, you know, there's a number of songs that people just demand that you want to take a break from, you know, and that people don't really believe me, but there was about three or four years where we did not play Star Wearing Purple at all. Like, we just took a serious, you know, detour from that song. And it was just fine, you know, because it's a great song. You know, I'm glad people enjoy it. It's not my central fundamental, like, you know, this is not what I would put in into Voyager, you know, if it, if I need, if like that was a task or, you know, to represent Gogol Bordello in the Voyager. It's a kind of funny thing about that song is that it's very underlooked in a way that, you know, it brings in like my favorite philosophers into the game, Michael Foucault and Diogenes. And
it all from Diogenes to the Foucault, from Ложечкин до Паспарту. И я клянусь, обоссав два пальца, что ты, а? Что музыка пошла от звука в му.
It is funny to me that Star Wars and Purple serves as kind of common denominator from all, for all kind of different pockets of Gogol Bordello fans, because we have very diverse audiences, you know, Latin community, then, you know, the punk rock, old school, new school punk rock, you know, people who just are kind of adventurous and, you know, more from, or people from more like Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds and Birthday Party kind of world, who are getting their vitamins and, you know, out of our music differently. But that song just seems to kind of bring everybody together. And at the same time, the aspects of it that it's actually kind of brings in these characters is completely underlooked, which is kind of was my main driving force. Like, how do you bring like heavy, you know, analytical information and references into something that's very jolly and kind of, that was my idea of a party. You know, how do you, how do you kind of trigger off all these higher intellectual frequencies in a party setting, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. What is that song about, Eugene? And why do you think people like that song so much?
Well, it does roll off your tongue, and it's one of the songs that wrote itself, and people can always tell that. Man, there is quite a several songs that we have that, you know, every songwriter knows this, and you know, every composer knows this. Some things just really write themselves in 10 minutes. Like, there seems to be almost zero effort behind it. And that ease is definitely a part of the charm of those kind of songs. And you can tell that probably, you know, the Pixies, you know, with your feet in the air and your hand on the ground, that's probably came from that same portal, you know. It doesn't sound like it was labored and toiled on for too long. It just came as almost ready-made email, you know, although I might be wrong. But, and then there are songs that people really toil over, and some of them are still become, you know, big songs. But like, you know, I definitely toiled over Wanderlust King for about 6 months before it really became what it is. And I added that bridge, kind of very symphonic, swashbuckling, many chords out of nowhere coming into bridge that kind of takes that song out of this kind of almost knucklehead kind of land, you know, at first seemingly. Yeah. I stay on the run. Yeah, run. Let me out. Let me be gone. That came almost basically at the last day, like right before the recording. It just was like, the song is still locking. So there's a lot of labor that goes into that, and in that sense, and maybe boiling down the lyrics, you know. So there's those two distinctly different ways of writing songs, plus the band's impact. You know, the band can just transform a song to yet completely another level, and it often does. But the ease of Star Wars and Purple, it's walking speed. You know, I was listening to a lot of Time Out of Mind at that point, And, you know, I think that most of the songs on that album just start with, I'm walking, or I've been walking, or I walked on it. It's just like, I was kind of in the frame of mind that I gotta do a couple of songs in a walking mode. Yeah. And, you know, it kind of rolled off my tongue, you know.
Would Not a Crime fall into that group of songs that you play almost every night?
Yes. Yeah, that's that song I need to play every night, along with I Would Never Want to Be Young Again. Those are the songs that, like, uncork my, you know, adrenaline capabilities. After that, I'm on, you know. Even if I was sleeping 10 minutes before that, you know, backstage, if we, like, you know, sometimes it's just like, you know, flying, and you pass out and you wake up, and, you know, and it's time to rock out. So, but those are the songs that kind of get me completely back into the frame of mind that this is what is going to be happening, you know, for the next 2 hours. And Not a Crime is very powerful. It has the melody is a actual traditional Romani melody, and a very kind of obscure one. This is like Romani, like private Romani repertoire that it's not one of those like beat up, you know, everybody kind of like knows that particular, identifies it as one of those gypsy, you know, music licks. It's a really kind of actually well-researched and thing that I sped up to the style of Gogol Bordello and made it into this crazy ass stomper. And then connected with the guys that in Italy, this Romani band from Italy that recorded that melody in completely different situation, like years before that. And I basically rearranged the thing, created Gogol Bordello classic out of it, then reunited with that band and played it together with them. And, you know, there's a connection with that. So it's kind of quintessential gypsy punk number, you know?
I'm wondering if there's anywhere in the world that you haven't toured. You've gone to South America. We know that. We saw that in the documentary. You go to Europe. Obviously, you travel around the U.S. and North America. Are there Gogol Bordello fans everywhere in the world?
Well, I mean, it's a stretch to say everywhere. I mean, everywhere where it's doable, you know.
Do you play Asia?
No, not really. I mean, no. We've definitely been to, you know, Japan, Australia, you know, and we haven't been to New Zealand, for example, which is doable. But we've been great many times, and not enough, but in Latin America and Central America, you know, and of course Europe, the whole Mediterranean, and the, you know, Turkey and Scandinavia, and all these pockets of Europe, Eastern Europe, obviously, you know, we've been there great many times, and a lot of our touring actually happened there before we got on radar of like England and the States. Actually, the cool part about it is that by the time we started playing, you know, UK, and the band was in a kind of pretty ass-kicking Olympic shape, you know, it looked like we had our thing pretty together at that time. You know, we already had hundreds of shows under our belt at that point.
Tell us a little bit about Nikolai Gogol.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, where do we begin?
Well, how did you first become aware? Yeah.
Well, and it's part of, you know, it's part of Ukrainian school, high school and elementary school curriculum, actually. So it's you know, his monuments are everywhere, and there's a lot of films that are based in his writings, and it's a revered classic. The thing about it is that it would be like, you know, yeah, it's Mark. It's I'd be like, how did Mark Twain get in your radar? You know.
Mm-hmm.
So, the thing about it that made it emblematic, particularly for me, was way after I left. Yeah, you know, it was one of the books that I kind of brought with me. The Nights on the Evenings Near Dikanka. It was kind of Gogol's first big monumental work, that kind of his debut that championed this all these pockets of Ukrainian like mythology and history that were at the time forbidden in Russia by, you know, Russian Tsar and then consequently kind of was always considered like Gogol's a very masterful smuggle of Ukrainian folklore and culture into, you know, just kind of jumping through these imperial hoops that were set up, you know, and kind of beating them, because a lot of people fell in love with that and were like, wow, there's this whole thing that's distinctly different culture. Why do they even call it like part of Russia? It's not Russia at all. So that's what kind of through his mastery he was able to do. And not only by dwelling in Ukrainian themes and kind of getting all these intellectuals and European literary critics to acknowledge this particular Ukrainian culture that's very distinctly not anything else but Ukrainian, but he was, if you read like literary analysts, there are some really deep researches where it shows that Gogol was going as far as writing using Ukrainian syntaxes and particular melodisms and rich patterns and rhythms of the speech while using, you know, Russian words so he can get published. And that's why his whole presentation of the culture was so hypnotic. Once again, it was so, as a Ukrainian guy who was born and raised out of Kazakh lineage, out of Ukrainian Kazakh lineage, and whose father was also a writer for a local theater, Vertep, and a collector of mythology. I mean, once again, you know, Gogol didn't fall out of nowhere. He came from a tree, a family tree, who was highly educated and well-versed in Ukrainian and Polish folklore. And one of the catalysts for me was that eventually I read this whole essay that I unburied somewhere of Gogol analyzing all these Ukrainian folk songs and showing how to read them and how to read into them. And it kind of put, you know, on ahead my whole understanding of Ukrainian culture. You know, it just really blew the, kind of, I cracked the code of it. Like, I wasn't taking it as for granted anymore. I just kind of looked at it, and it's all with all these nuances and how to really understand the culture, the role of that particular culture in this, in a European setting.
You know, in the last year and a half, a lot of Americans, and I imagine people elsewhere around the world who had some vague awareness of Ukraine have learned a lot more about the country. You have this position and this platform to teach people about the Ukraine. And have you done anything to take advantage of your position to talk to people about Ukraine or educate them? Or have you found people to be curious? What's your experience been like?
Well, luckily, you know, I'm not a singular person on that front. You know, there's actually quite great educators who are doing it as educators, like Timothy Snyder, you know, who's kind of a great expert, you know, or there's great journalists and educators like Terrell Starr, you know, of African-American descent, who are heavy Ukraine experts, and are actually, he's in Ukraine right now. And so, you know, their focus is like distinctly educating people, because that's what they do. Yeah. Here, you know, as you know, as a punk rocker or as an entertainer or whatever, you know, other ways you can look at it, you know, you don't necessarily have academic cred to be perceived as such. But I think that for some people, you know, Gogol Bordello might be their only connection to Ukraine. I mean, there's tons of people who are like that, you know, who are, for one reason or another, that is their first way of having to do anything with it, you know, and of course they have learned about it more because of us, you know, and simply because we've been encouraging people to pay attention to it and not view it as some kind of local conflict, you know, and understand that it's pretty far from being local. I mean, you know, if in fact, it's kind of like a cop out, you know, when people are talk about it, like, oh, like they view it as some kind of, there are some people who are still doing it. Like, oh, it's just like some kind of soccer game that's going on over there across the ocean. And what are they doing there? Can they just figure it out already? You know, that's just a really appalling point of view, because well, some of those people just simply don't have it, all the ingredients in the head to be focused enough. Some of them just have different agenda. Some of them are, you know, worked on heavy by pro-Russian propaganda. And some of them are just yet to find out really what's up. And what they're going to find out is that, you know, look, like just several years before the war, perhaps everybody remembers how much unrest there was about these simple topics that, you know, there was Russian influence on elections, that some things were, you know, it was like everybody's appalled about it. It's just like, do you think that it's a local conflict somewhere far away where the players of that game that you think is so far away are messing with your election? Maybe it's not so far away. So how these fucking people don't put two and two together and view it as a situation that definitely needs to be resolved with global, you know, with entire world's kind of interaction and attention.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. It's pretty black and white to me, you know?
Yeah. So as we sort of wind down, I want to make sure I ask you about United Strike Back. How did that come together?
Oh yeah. Actually, thanks for bringing that up. You know, one of them really kind of, listen, I'm a life punk rocker. Like, I'm a lifer, you know, and, that's my foundation. From, I was in the bands, punk bands, since I was 13 years old, you know, and back in Ukraine and everywhere in between, and now here. You know, when you were a lifer punk rocker, it kind of goes without saying that, you know, you kind of know what it's all, if you know, you know, and that's all there is to it, you know. So over the course of years, it's almost kind of becomes like a thing in your back pocket. Like, it's just, and a lot of bands in punk rock and in all the forms of music affiliated with it, gone through a similar process. Some of them kind of were still affiliated with that, but they're kind of start drifting away and, you know, exploring other vibes and being seen on some more eclectic bills that sometimes don't make any sense to a punk rocker. However, this, when the war began, it was like a catalyst to where punk rock bands, new school, old school, mid school punk rock bands, kind of demonstrated their vitality like nobody else once again. And it's just kind of, to me, it was so inspiring once again. Why did we even get into this form of music, into this particular cultural movement? Why did we even went with it at the first place? Because there's a big difference. There's a big difference between supporting Ukraine, like, you know, 6 months after the war, when it was kind of like things already assumed a certain direction. A lot of people were already on the side of Ukraine. But it's a lot different when, you know, you're the first person who sees through everything and then goes out and, you know, 2 days after the war has begun, already, you know, puts out a song. It's called God Save Ukraine. You know, I'm talking about Sick of It All from New York City. Like, there it is. It's on Bandcamp, you know, and the lyrics are like, you know, God Save Ukraine, you know, from the evil moron, you know. And it's a very instant punk rock from, you know, Spitfire approach. And yeah, and the next week, literally days after the beginning, we were already getting a benefit together, benefit concert, first concert for Ukraine that happened with Patti Smith, you know, Jesse Malin, you know, Susanna Vega, Netanyahu, you know, so all our friends that one way or another, you know, whether they're old school, you know, icons like Patti Smith with a strong stance right away. That provided a big sense of direction, you know, to a lot of people who are or just didn't have any sense of direction. And, you know, Jello Biafra, of course, you know, and we put out a song with Les Claypool, which was actually his initiative, you know. And you know, most of the people I just, you know, brought up, they are all one way or another affiliated with punk rock, whether they're proto-punk, you know, icons like Patti Smith, or kind of prog rock, punk rockers like Les Claypool, you know. And it was just beautiful to see that, you know, once again, here we go, you know, the people who created politically edged conscious music back in the day that we listened to and aspired to and were, you know, grateful to this day, here they are again, not waiting for anybody to like, hey, can you guys whip something together here? No, they're like, you know, reach out to you. So the answer to your question, United Strike Back was the song that I wrote to bring back, to bring people that had that clear vision of that situation together on one track, you know, who I always particularly looked up to as were kind of, you know, my, was one of my greatest inspirations, like Roger Miret from Agnostic Front, you know, and, you know, Jello Biafra, of course.
Very cool. And,
you know, Monty from Ministry. We actually recorded another track with Ministry. I don't want to jump any gun, but there's a song with it's coming out basically. Yeah, I mean, Old Jurgensen being kind of one of my favorite sonic maverick of all times. You know, just, you know, well, Trey Cool from Green Day is the, laid down the drums for that song, you know. Joe Lally from Fugazi, you know. So once again, you know, so it was a naturally occurring awesomeness in a way. It was just takes an effort to coordinate so many people, but you know, over the years I grew some producer muscle, and you know, I really enjoy those kind of collaborations when they're made between people who actually know each other and know where we all coming from.
Yeah,
that goes a long way for a spirited collaboration.
Eugene, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day to talk to us.
Yeah, of course.
The documentary, Scream of My Blood, so incredible. It's one of those things you almost have to watch more than once because there's so much going on. But continued success. Great talking with you today.
Bring in something more current from just tag our new album in.
Yeah, tell us about it.
And, you know, once again, the kind of the vitality of punk rock and how, as a movement, how it demonstrated itself in this particular situation, it kind of was probably one of the factors that the last album that we recorded was actually kind of stripped down to quintessential elements of Gogol Bordello once again, because we're an adventurous band, and I think that because we have some great arpeggio players in the band, like Sergei, our violin player, you know, coming in from classical music world, always bringing in dimension of class, you know, classical music class. You know, it's a very seductive element, and I think it brought us into this sinful punk rock ambitious state of mind that kind of peaked at Seekers and Finders album. You know, I think that was our sinful punk rock album that kind of this oxymoronic ambition of sinful punk, it crescendoed there. And in a way, for creative reasons, for adventure reasons, and also just the rawness of the times we live in, everything kind of brought us back to this much more raw sound of, you know, punk hardcore gist of Gogol Bordello to begin with, in a way showing a very important part of its makeup, because a lot of our fans are not really aware of, like, our history. Like, for them, it starts with Gypsy Punks, but that was already our third album. The albums that have that kind of, you know, very quick gist of punk and hardcore influences, they're under people's radar. And, you know, making the record in particular with, you know, Walter Schreifels as a producer, who is, you know, one of my favorite musicians, that kind of unites so many different, you know, streaks of hardcore, you know, as a guy who's been in Youth of Today, you know, Gorilla Biscuits. He even played in Warzone for a while. Then, you know, went on being Quicksand frontman, Rival Schools. Yeah, it's just like such a vital force in that world. And we had so much fun making this record. It was almost more like starting a band together when you were like 14 years old in a garage. I had that more spirit than rather than like, here we are, seasoned rockers, making, producing a new record that we really know how it goes. It was just like, no, as long as it's raw and it's exciting and, you know, let's not mess too much with it.
Thanks again so much for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for having me. Yeah.
Yeah.